And now Damian Lewis reads part two of The Scarlet Pimpernel by Baroness Orczy, her enduringly popular romantic adventure story set at the time of the French Revolution. The Comtesse de Tournai and her two children are safe in England and staying at the Fisherman's Rest in Dover. But old enemies are to be found even here. Marguerite St. Just had previously denounced the Comtesse's cousin and sent him to his death. Now she's married to Sir Percy Blakeney and expected to arrive at any moment at the inn.
Lady Blakeney swept into the coffee room. With a quick glance, she took stock of everyone there. She nodded pleasantly to Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, whilst extending a hand to Lord Antony. "Hallo, my Lord Tony! Why, what are you doing here in Dover?" she said merrily. Then, without waiting for a reply, she turned and faced the Comtesse and Suzanne. "Why, if that isn't my little Suzanne over there! Pardieu! How came you to be in England? And Madame, too?" "Suzanne, I forbid you to speak to that woman. Come," said the Comtesse, and without another look at Marguerite Blakeney, she sailed majestically out of the room. As Suzanne was about to follow her mother, filial obedience vanished before girlish sympathy. At the door she turned, ran back to Marguerite, and kissed her effusively. Then only did she follow her mother. As they disappeared through the door, a pleasant, though distinctly inane, laugh was heard from outside, and the next moment a richly dressed figure appeared in the doorway. Sir Percy Blakeney was still a year or two on the right side of 30, tall above the average even for an Englishman, broad-shouldered and massively built. He would have been called unusually good-looking but for a certain lazy expression in his deep-set blue eyes and that perpetual inane laugh which seemed to disfigure his strong, clearly-cut mouth. It was nearly a year ago now that Sir Percy Blakeney Bart had astonished fashionable society by bringing home a beautiful, fascinating, clever French wife. How the sleepiest, dullest, most British Britisher ever came to captivate the cleverest woman in Europe, as her friends unanimously called her, no one ventured to guess. He ambled into the room, shaking the wet off his fine overcoat. Then he surveyed the company, upon whom an embarrassed silence had fallen. "La!" said Sir Percy. "How sheepish you all look! What's up?" "Oh, nothing, Sir Percy," replied Marguerite with a certain amount of gaiety, which, however, sounded somewhat forced. "Nothing to disturb your equanimity, only an insult to your wife." "Begad! Who was the bold man who dared to tackle you, eh?" The young Vicomte, who had elected not to follow his mother from the room, quickly stepped forward. "Monsieur," he said with an elaborate bow, "my mother, the Comtesse de Tournai de Basserive, has offended Madame, who I see as your wife. I cannot ask your pardon for my mother. What she does is right in my eyes. But I am ready to offer you the usual reparation between men of honour."
"What the devil is that?" asked Sir Percy blandly.
"A duel, monsieur," he stammered. Blakeney turned, and from his great height looked down at the Vicomte. But not for a second did he lose his own imperturbable good humour. He laughed and said, "A bloodthirsty young ruffian! As for me, sir, I never fight duels. Damned uncomfortable things, duels, ain't they, Tony?" Lord Antony laid a friendly hand on the young Frenchman's shoulder. "It would hardly be fitting that you should commence your career in England by provoking Sir Percy to a duel," he said.
"Ah, well, if Monsieur is satisfied, I have no griefs. You, milor, are our protector. If I have done wrong, I withdraw myself."
"Aye, do," rejoined Blakeney. "Withdraw yourself over there, damned excitable little puppy." He added under his breath, "Faith, folks, if that's a specimen of the goods you and your friends bring over from France, my advice to you is drop a mid-channel, my friend, or I should have to see old Pitt about it. Get him to clap on a prohibitive tariff."
"'Sfaith, Sir Percy,
to be afraid of a little French boy," said Marguerite with a long and merry laugh.
"Fuchs, mark ye that? I have made my wife laugh. The cleverest woman in Europe. Odds fish! We must have a bowl on that."
And he tapped vigorously on the table.
"Hey! Jelly! Quick, man! A bowl of punch!"
"Nay, there is no time, Sir Percy," interposed Marguerite. "The skipper will be here directly, and my brother must get on board, or the Daydream will miss the tide. And you are all such merry company," she continued, "that I trust you will forgive me if I bid my brother goodbye outside." Marguerite led her brother Armand Saint-Just towards the cliffs. A gentle sea breeze blew her hair about her face as she looked into the distance towards the shores of France. "Our own beautiful country, Marguerite," said Armand, who seemed to have divined her thoughts. "They are going too far, Armand," she said. "You are a Republican, so am I, but even you must think they are going too far."
"Hush," said Armand instinctively as he threw glances around apprehensively.
"Ah, you see, you don't think yourself that it is safe to speak of these things, even here in England. Don't go back, Armand. Remember, I have only you."
"Nay, sweet one, Percy cares for you."
"He did once."
"Margot, listen. I have not spoken of these things to you before, but I feel as if I could not go away and leave you without asking you one question."
"What is it?"
"Does Sir Percy Blakeney know the part you played in the arrest of the Marquis de Saint-Cyr?" She laughed bitterly.
"That I denounced him to the tribunal? That ultimately sent him and his family to the guillotine?"
"Yes. I told him after I married him."
"You told him all the circumstances, which so completely exonerated you from any blame?"
"It was too late to talk of circumstances. He heard the story from other sources. My confession came too tardily. Besides, Sir Percy's dull wits cling only to facts. They would not understand circumstances, and I could not demean myself by trying to explain."
"And?"
"And now I have the satisfaction, Armand, of knowing that the biggest fool in England has the most complete contempt for his wife."
But she would not spoil these last moments with Armand by speaking further about her unhappiness, and she led him along the cliffs and down to the beach. The Daydream had set sail, and Marguerite Blakeney stood alone watching those white sails which bore so swiftly away from her the only being who really cared for her, whom she knew she could trust. With a heavy sigh, she turned away from the sea and walked slowly back towards the Fisherman's Rest. Through the gloom, she perceived a stranger coming rapidly towards her, and she quickened her steps. The stranger paused when he saw Marguerite, and just as she was about to slip past him, he said very quietly,
"Citoyenne Saint-Just."
She looked up at the stranger.
"Chauvelin!"
she exclaimed.
"Himself, citoyenne, at your service,"
said the stranger, gallantly kissing the tips of her fingers. Marguerite surveyed the figure before her. Chauvelin was then nearer 40 than 30, clever and shrewd-looking, with a curious fox-like expression in his deep, sunken eyes, and he was indeed that same stranger who an hour or two previously had joined Mr. Jellyband in a friendly glass of wine.
"Chauvelin, I am mightily pleased to see you," said Marguerite. "But tell me, what in the world are you doing here in England?"
"I present my credentials to Mr. Pitt tomorrow," he said. "What of yourself?"
"Oh, I?" she said with a shrug of the shoulders. "Je m'ennuie, mon ami, that is all. I was hoping that perhaps you had a prescription against the malady, my little Chauvelin."
"Perhaps I have," he said. "It is called work. Will you render France a small service, citoyenne?" he asked with a sudden change of manner.
"It depends upon the kind of service she or you want."
"Have you ever heard of the Scarlet Pimpernel, citoyenne Saint-Just?"
asks Chauvelin abruptly.
"Heard of the Scarlet Pimpernel?" she retorted with a long and merry laugh. "Faith, man, we talk of nothing else."
"Then you must know that the man who hides his identity under that strange pseudonym is the most bitter enemy of our Republic of France, of men like Armand Saint-Just."
"I dare swear he is," she said with a sigh. "France has many bitter enemies these days."
"But you, citoyenne, are a daughter of France, and should be ready to help her in a moment of deadly peril."
"But I can do nothing here in England."
"Yes, you can," he urged. "Listen, I have been sent over here by the Republican government as its representative. I go to London tomorrow. One of my duties here is to find out all about this League of the Scarlet Pimpernel, headed by a man whose brain seems as resourceful as his identity is mysterious. Find that man for me, citoyenne," he urged. "Find him for France."
"Chauvelin, you are astonishing," said Marguerite. "Where in the world am I to look for him?"
"You go everywhere, citoyenne. Lady Blakeney is the pivot of social London, so I am told. You see everything, you hear everything."
"Tush, man, you talk nonsense anyway, for even if you did know who this Scarlet Pimpernel is, you could do nothing to him."
"An Englishman."
"I take my chance of that," said Chauvelin with a rasping laugh. "We could send him to the guillotine first. Then, when there is a diplomatic fuss about it, we can apologize, humbly, to the British government."
"What you propose is evil, Chauvelin," she said, drawing away from him. "I refuse to do any dirty work for you or for France. That is my last word."
And without another look at Chauvelin, Marguerite Blakeney turned her back and walked straight into the inn. Later that night at the Fisherman's Rest, only Lord Antony and Sir Andrew Ffoulkes remained in the coffee room. It was quite dark, save for a circle of light from the blazing logs in the hearth.
"Well, you'll be doing the journey next, Tony, I expect," said Sir Andrew. "You and Hastings, certainly. It will be the Comte de Tournay, of course."
The two young men drew their chairs together and lowered their voices. "I saw the Scarlet Pimpernel alone for a few moments in Calais," said Sir Andrew. "Have you any instructions for me?"
"Yes.
Rather more precise ones than usual. It appears that the Republican government has sent an accredited agent over here. His name is Chauvelin, with a whole army of spies. And until the chief has sampled the lot, he thinks we should meet as little as possible. When he wants to speak to us, he'll contrive to let us know." Sir Andrew had taken out a pocketbook and drawn therefrom a paper. "You are to read these instructions, then destroy them," he said. So intent were they that neither man heard nor saw a figure emerge from under one of the benches. Then a noise from the passage beyond attracted their attention. Lord Antony crossed the room and threw open the door, and as he did so, he received a stunning blow between the eyes. Simultaneously, the figure, skulking in the gloom, leapt upon Sir Andrew from behind and felled him. All this happened within a space of seconds, and before either could cry out, they were each seized by two men, and a muffler was tied around the mouth of each. One man had, in the meanwhile, quietly shut the door.
"Now search their pockets," he ordered.
This was done, and the masked man took possession of their papers. One letter in particular seemed to give him satisfaction, and his foxy eyes glinted in the firelight.
"Armand Saint-Just, a traitor after all," he murmured to himself. "Now, fair Marguerite Blakeney, you will help me to find the Scarlet Pimpernel."
Damian Lewis was reading the second part of The Scarlet Pimpernel by Baroness Ortsey. The book is abridged by Sarah Kilgariff, and it was a CSA Word production for BBC Radio 2 by Clive Stanhope. Next week, armed with the knowledge that Armand Saint-Just is a traitor, Chauvelin seeks another meeting with Marguerite.